Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. Journalists and science aren't always a successful mixture, but Dr. Julian Cribb is an Australian journalist who's more than made his mark as a science communicator. But what he has to communicate isn't always a happy message. Indeed, the title of his session at last week's Late at the Museum event in Auckland was Earth's Gravest Challenge. He's with us now to explain. Well, Julian, the talk at the museum was called Earth's Greatest Challenge. What is it?
Well, basically, can we feed ourselves when there's 10 billion human beings for 50 years? Can we sustain the food supply? It's doubling the amount of food that we're producing today. And at the same time, there are all these huge constraints coming down. We're running short of water. We're running short of land. We're running short of oil. We're running short of fertilizer. We're running short of science and technology. We're running short of fish. And we're running short of stable climates. So all of those things combine to make food insecurity much greater now and in future than it has been in the last 30 years.
The optimist would say, well, Malthus said that, 100 years ago, and he wasn't right. Why is it a crisis now?
Malthus didn't actually say that. Malthus said that food tends to outrun, or human population tends to outrun the production of food. What we had a successful green revolution in the 60s and 70s. We put a lot of effort into agricultural science and technology, and we doubled the world food supply in about 15 years. We have forgotten to do that again. We have taken our foot off the accelerator. We have not reinvested in agricultural science and technology worldwide, I'm talking. And as a result of that, demand from, rising demand generated by population increase and by growing economic demand in countries like China, India, Brazil, and so on, as people increase their incomes and they can afford more food, that's gradually sneaking up on food production. It's gradually overtaking it. So when we have a drought or a flood or something like that, and there is a shortfall in the food, there's an instant shock which goes through world markets.
So that's the good news. Is there a positive aspect to this? Are we still able, is it too late, are we still able to change things? Do we need another green revolution?
Yes, absolutely we do. We need massive reinvestment in science and technology to develop a new form of eco-agriculture, one that is sustainable. The current form of agriculture worldwide is not sustainable.
In what sense?
Well, it's burning through too much soil. It's burning through. It's dependent on oil, which we know is going to run out in 10 or 20 years' time. It's dependent on artificial fertilizers, which we know are going to run short over the next 50 years. So it's dependent on a whole lot of things that are going to run out. So we need a new agriculture. We also need to change our diet. Worldwide, we can't all eat like Americans and expect to survive on this planet. You'd need four planet Earths, basically, to feed 10 billion people like Americans. So that's not sustainable. So we need to moderate the diet, and that would be good for us as well because, half of people nowadays die as a result of what they eat. Half of the diseases that kill us are diet-related.
We talk about cutting back, therefore, on fertilizers, on oil. These are a lot of the advances that helped us be more efficient in producing food in the first place, weren't they?
They were indeed, and that's why we've got to reinvent agriculture. We can't rely on the same old formula to feed us when there's 10 billion of us demanding food at a higher level that we relied on in the 1960s and 70s when there are only about 4 or 5 billion people.
Is the kind of agricultural practice you're talking about, does it exist now? Is it something we have to invent?
Yeah, no, it doesn't exist now. Everybody's agriculture is not sustainable now, but many farmers are working on it. And many scientists are working on it. We just need to make a greater effort to get there. But it's a major ask. This is bigger than curing cancer. There is no scientific challenge as large as this one in renewing the world's food supply.
Would it be okay? I went to Pakistan a couple of years ago. Their dairy production is woeful compared to the number of cows they have simply because they're not following standard Western practices of producing milk. So, by establishing those, many of them were quadrupling their milk supply overnight. Is it merely a case of getting existing people up to best practice, or do we have to go beyond that?
In many cases it is. We can develop people to help them farm like New Zealand farmers farm or Australian farmers farm. But on the other hand, half the world is fed by smallholders, people who are using a little kitchen garden. And they need help, because that's half the world's food supply coming from there. So they need help to lift their yields and to farm more sustainably. And we don't want to hook them on oil or fertilizer or the other things that are going to run out, petrochemicals.
What about water?
water is running out as well. The main reason for that is that not only is the climate changing, cities are taking the farmers' water away. So you're seeing cities like Shanghai are just soaking the rice farmers' water. They're taking it away from him. Worldwide, the amount of water consumed by cities is going to double, okay? And that's going to halve the amount of water available to irrigation farmers right when you're asking them to double the food production. So you're halving the water while you're asking them to double. So that's a very big ask, technically speaking.
These are a lot of hard choices you're talking about, whereas I get the impression that with the first Green Revolution, one reason it worked is because there was a dollar to be made from it. Is that going to be the case here?
Yes, absolutely. So there are huge opportunities. You know, if it sounds grim, there are also great opportunities. Countries like New Zealand that are highly skilled in agriculture and science have got marvellous opportunities to both to reinvent agriculture, to come up with a new diet, to develop systems that are more sustainable. You can take cities like Auckland, and instead of throwing all your nutrients away, you can recycle those nutrients back into agriculture, back into hydroponics or horticulture. The world's cities have got to do that, you know, because we're building these immense cities of 30 and 40 million people, which produce none of their own food. And their food comes on a river of trucks every single night. And if that river of trucks breaks down at any point, like there's a fuel crisis or a war or something, a city of 30 or 40 million people will starve within days. So we need to redevelop agricultural systems or food-producing systems within our cities.
When you say we, does that mean that there has to be a lead at government level? Is that the most important thing?
When I say we, I mean we, the human race, because this touches all of us, okay? If there is a food shortage, the price goes through the roof. Everybody pays for it in the supermarket. If there is a major food shortage in a given area, say the Indo-Gangetic Plain, the North China Plain, North Africa, you will see wars break out. You will see governments fall, as we have done in the last few months. We saw Tunisia and Egypt, two governments turfed out because the people were rioting over food prices. You will see conflicts. We'll get sucked into conflicts that we didn't want to be in, and tens of millions of refugees. So if we want to avoid that kind of circumstance, we need to take the knowledge we have now and share it with these countries so we can stabilise their food production systems.
We know how hard it is to get concerted cooperation over climate change, for instance. I mean, we haven't done a lot in the last 20 years in terms of moving forward on that, or not as much as we should. Do you have any more hope that when it comes to our food source that we will, especially as it's often the third world, the developing nations who have the greatest problems?
Yes, because with climate change, we have not personally experienced serious pain yet as a result of the change in the climate. Some people have, but most people haven't. So people are not really, motivated to do a lot about it, including governments. And climate change is not really going to bite until the mid part and the latter part of the century, you know. But with food crises, you can get an immediate spike in food prices, and every government's head is on the block when that happens.
Are we seeing that already? Is that what we see? I mean, there are news stories daily about the price of fruit and vegetables skyrocketing. Is that what we're seeing?
We've seen it all through history. I mean, when the French ran out of food in the 18th century, we got the French Revolution. When the Russians ran out of food early in the 20th century, we got the Russian Revolution. We've seen, as I say, Egypt and Tunisian governments both fall over as a result of food protests. So governments are very, very vulnerable to this, and politicians had better realise this, that if they neglect this issue, they take their eye off this particular ball, they're in a lot of trouble. And I think that means that we are probably going to act on it more promptly than we are on climate change.
Does biotechnology have a role here? Because there are people who are deeply wary still of genetic modification technologies. Do you think that's going to be important?
I understand that. I think we need every technology that we've got to improve food sustainability and food production. What that technology is and who's going to eat it, that's a decision for the consumer. So the consumers are actually going to decide. If they don't want a particular technology, they will reject it. If they don't mind it, and I believe that with biotechnology, once there is a benefit for the consumer instead of a benefit for a big agribusiness company, consumers will start eating it. If, for example, your bread is going to protect you against bowel cancer, there's a good chance you might eat it. So, you know, I think that people will become more relaxed about biotechnology.
One of the things that's hampered the developments with climate change is the presence of a strong denier cohort. Is that the same? Are you facing the same challenges here? Are there people out there saying, "Oh, we're never going to run out of food"?
Yes, but they tend to be people who live in places like America where they've got food coming out of their ears, you know. They're not in touch with what's happening. They're not in touch with the billion people who are starving at the moment. They're not seeing, you know, the 500 children who died just in the course of this interview. They're not seeing that stuff in front of their eyes, and they're not realising how serious it is. But they are seeing the prices go up in the supermarket. So I think that those people will be non-sceptical once these signals start to bite.
You've mentioned our ability in New Zealand to trade on our technological developments and perhaps help other countries. What other opportunities do you think we have here?
Well, the demand in the coming sort of 20 or 30 years is going to be for agricultural knowledge. Every country in the world is going to need that to develop more sustainable systems. New Zealand farmers, New Zealand scientists are very, very good at that. So this is a huge opportunity for New Zealand, not just as a commodity or a food exporter, but really as a knowledge exporter. I mean, you could convert this to a knowledge economy. This could be the Silicon Valley of agriculture if you really put your minds to it. But you have to reinvest in the science and technology.
Well, I'm quite happy to end on that relatively optimistic note. Dr. Julian Cribb, thank you.
Thanks very much.
That's Julian Cribb. After the break, filmmaker Florian Havoc with his take on the classic boy meets girl love story and new music from Cut Off Your Hands.